It's Mystery Crate. It's Mike Ryan, and I got a treat for you on this episode, this special midweek episode of Mystery Crate. Those who have listened to Billy's MTV The Challenge Breakdown episodes of Mystery Crate have grown familiar with Charlie Kravitz. Charlie Kravitz produces Highly Questionable, a very difficult show to produce. He does a tremendous job with that. I like the stuff that he's done with Mystery Crate, and I offered him an open invitation. And I said, Charlie, anytime you want to create, anytime you want to have a discussion, and you need a platform, Mystery Crate is here so long as it meets our standard. And boys, I almost laughed at myself when I said, meeting our standard, because for the love of God, it's a podcast that keeps you on your toes, that has no real genre to it, that is really just made for the diehards of the Dan Le Batard show. So I believe this meets that standard. It's actually conceptually a really cool idea. I'm 34 years old. I have memories of Michael Jordan playing, but what if we spoke to people that were younger? I was really interested in the millennials' perspective of Michael Jordan, because Michael Jordan is this mythical figure that they really don't have much memory of playing the game. They just know that everyone who's anyone is compared to Michael Jordan. And millennials, I don't know if you've noticed this, have sort of been unfairly dragged into every conversation ever. You get 40-something-year-old sports fans, and they're going to say something bad about millennials. Either way, Charlie Kravitz had a discussion with fellow millennial. I hate using this as a way to describe people, but it's how I sell it. So follow me on this one. Fellow millennial and former HQ staffer Clay Skipper, who now writes for GQ, joins Charlie Kravitz for an interesting conversation, a breakdown of The Last Dance from a millennial's perspective, a perspective that you're not really hearing from all that often when people decide to gas bag about The Last Dance. So I think you'll enjoy this. I did. This is us taking a stab. That's what Mystery Crate's all about. Maybe put new voices on your radar. Charlie Kravitz and Clay Skipper are new voices for many of you. So here we go. A Last Dance breakdown from millennials, Charlie Kravitz and Clay Skipper, here on the Mystery Crate, breaking down The Last Dance. Enjoy.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Mystery Crate. I am your host this week, Charlie Kravitz, and I'm joined by my good friend, GQ writer, overall handsome guy, if you check his Instagram, Clay Skipper. Clay, what's up?
What's up, Charlie? Good to be here, man.
Not much. I think that we're going to discuss the one thing that there is to discuss in the sports world right now, and that is putting a bow on The Last Dance. And Clay, both you and I are millennials. I was born in 1989. I believe you were as well.
I was.
Which means we had a very different perspective on Michael Jordan than everyone else. We were there for the man, the myth, the legend. We watched him transform into the man, the meme, the legend. And now we're sort of watching as he tries to take control of the narrative again and explain to us why he was great. And I think we should sort of start by, I'm going to ask you, did The Last Dance have the desired effect that you think Michael Jordan wanted with this documentary?
I think it did. I mean, I think it was completely amplified by these unforeseen circumstances of the coronavirus too. I mean, I think, you know, I remember when I originally first saw the trailer, and to your point about being born in 1989, like, I don't really remember specifically watching Jordan, but I do remember how, like, in the back of my mind, I just have always known that he's dominant and great. Cause I, even if I don't remember necessarily specific games, I just sort of had that ethos in my head. And so when I saw the trailer, I think I was just more like, oh, this is going to be a cool walk down memory lane full of incredible, you know, archival, unseen archival footage of MJ. But, you know, because of coronavirus putting a hold on all live sports, this obviously became appointment viewing. Like, it's the only thing that stopped the internet in the way that, like, I think Game of Thrones did. And so if MJ's, you know, if we're assuming MJ's intent with this was to sort of remind people how damn good he was, I think he has done that because, the conversation has been so amplified because there's nothing else out there to consume, right? So it's not like the conversation about MJ being great has had to compete with baseball and with, I mean, there's still NFL offseason, but just like all these other sports. So it has become the only conversation. So I think in that sense, it exceeded what I think Jordan may have been hoping to do.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I think there's like an interesting paradox that's gone on with it, where Michael's sort of on-court performance was so flawless. He was such a graceful, balletic athlete. It was almost like you watch these highlights, it seems like he was meant to play basketball. He was like Baryshnikov if he was 6'6". It was something that was like, there was artistry to this. So when you have this sort of comprehensive footage of his career in these highlights, I watched these 10 episodes and I counted 4 missed shots from Michael Jordan. You have this amazing visual narrative of this guy that's like so easy to understand why he was special and why he was really captivating to generations and generations and generations. But what's interesting is I think that ESPN's discourse and the way that they talked about the documentary was actually the biggest turnoff for me. Hmm. And I'm saying that as like as an ESPN stand, but like for years I've had, you know, my parents who are basketball fans and older people who I've worked with telling me their generation's better. The millennials are soft. The 80s were better. And this just ignited that conversation to the point that it became so toxic, even in my echo chamber on Twitter, that it made me want to push away from it. Like you had the Wilbons of the world saying Michael Jordan would score 50 points a game. Jalen Rose echoing that, talking about how no hand checking, all of this would be different and Michael would be even better, which just like runs counter to what I think in my head of how incredible the NBA product is and the sort of the evolution of athletes. And so that's the one pushback that I have is like, it turned classic journalists who are people that I looked up into like, to me, angry old men yelling from their lawn.
Yeah, I think in some ways it like just sort of made wider this divide between the old guard and, you know, everyone wants to compare MJ and LeBron, which is like a futile exercise because how the hell are you supposed to do that? But, you know, the people who ride really hard for Jordan, they're just riding harder now. And to your point, I think it makes younger people who might ride for LeBron even more sort of, I think you used the word antagonistic towards those sort of MJ stands from back then, right? It just seems like the two groups may have gotten more entrenched. Although I don't know, because I saw, did you see this poll on ESPN that said,
It was amazing.
It's outrageous.
And I have to cut you off for a second on this because there was one question in there that legitimately made me laugh out loud. Well, and that was when they said, more amazing.
Wait, and like, oh, I didn't even see that, really?
And 76% of the public thinks that Michael Jordan was more amazing than LeBron James.
Well, I mean, I will say that, you know, no knock on LeBron, but one of my biggest takeaways, like, obviously I knew MJ was great, and it doesn't make watching the footage any less cool because, like you said, it is just like the way he moves is so fluid and graceful. But I had forgotten how charismatic he is. Like, he is
amazing.
Yeah, exactly. So to the Paul's point, he is more amazing than LeBron. But I don't know. I was just shocked that so many people, like that poll to me, even though I have the feeling based on what we're talking about here and what the dialogue has been around the documentary, that this would sort of further polarize the people who take LeBron's side and people take MJ's side. I was shocked that poll said, you know, I think it was 76% of people prefer Jordan, and 65% of people said they'd rather have a drink with Jordan than James. And 62% of people said that Jordan had a more positive impact off the court. I mean, in terms of sheer basketball popularity, I guess I get that. But when it comes to like activism and sociopolitical stuff, I don't know how you could possibly say that Jordan had a bigger impact off the court.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that's fascinating about this whole thing is that charisma is king. And Michael Jordan being someone telling his own story and being that charismatic has covered up the fact that I don't feel that this is journalism. Like, him having control of the final product and essentially rewriting the narrative history of 20 years of NBA basketball and just saying his perspective is the way that it was is really unique. But listening to him talk and listening to the fact that he was able to settle grudges and essentially put up what he said he was going to do is like fascinating, and it's unique, and it's almost like legendary and what makes Michael Michael. But that's able to cover up a lot of the flaws in the documentary, and I think it shaped a lot of people's perspective that I find interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the take that is, and I have admittedly consumed not a ton of like I've watched all 10 episodes, but I have not consumed a ton of like meta coverage about The Last Dance, but I would assume, because it's the same knock I sort of had originally watching it, that people who are sort of old school capital J journalists are not super happy with this because it's not very objective, right? Like,
yeah,
not only is it about Jordan, but it makes Jordan the final word on everything, right? Like, he is the arbiter and adjudicator of everything that goes into the doc. And I totally get why, from a purely old school journalism, you know, objectivity standpoint, people have a problem with that. But then I was thinking about that, and like, those are some of the most compelling bits of the documentary, right? Like, handing Jordan the iPad and having him react to Isaiah Thomas talking about the not shaking their hands, or talking about Gary Payton shutting him down. Again, I get why, from an objectivity standpoint, that is not maybe the proper way to do it, but that was like some of the best stuff, right? And so I don't think this is a classic documentary, but I think if you take it face value, this is going to be from Jordan's perspective, then you can kind of get past the old, you know, notions of what, again, a capital J journalism documentary could be, and just sort of luxuriate in Jordan having all these incredible commentary, because you haven't really seen him comment on those moments. And that part was super cool.
Yeah, I just think that's a really good way to put it. I think that this was more of a piece about historical memory than actual journalism. And Michael was so charming. Even when he is an ass to Scott Burrell and a bully and something that would now be sort of canceled in our current culture, yeah, the way that he does it is such like a sort of a classic alpha male. And it always resulted in a win, that it was able to, like, you know, convince guys who would otherwise not consider this journalism to take this as gospel. And that's like a really interesting thing. And that's like also, you know, something about Michael Jordan commenting on these moments, because the historical memory of Michael Jordan to all of these journalists are like, these are probably some of the most happy, compelling, spectacular moments of their career. I mean, like, the guys that you and I and a lot of people look up to in this industry are guys who were awed by Michael Jordan. And then to hear him sort of corroborate all of the legend and the myth making that surrounded him and corroborate them as true from that perspective, I'm sure was exciting even for them.
Totally. Although I do think one area where they seem to have gone, like, I felt like, okay, by episode 6, 7, you know, I guess episode 7, 8, 9, I was like, they're pushing a little too hard, was, you know, they made it seem like MJ was the cause of, you know, when Scott Burrell had his, I don't remember, it was 24-point game, right? Like, they made it seem like that happened because MJ was hard on him. And like, I don't really know how closely tethered those things are. If it's a, you know, cause A leads to effect B. That felt to me like they were pushing that a little too much, but I don't know. I mean, maybe that is how it was. I think having someone like Jordan on your team, like, obviously drives you to work harder and want to play better and maybe rise to the moment, but it just made it seem like he was the sort of facilitating factor in everything.
Yeah, well, part of what's unique about that is I think Jordan believed that. I think to his core, he believed that he had to be an asshole to be great, and he thought he had to be an asshole to connect with these teammates who could in no way understand the pressure that was on him or what he was going through. And I don't think that's necessarily correct. I don't think being a legendary asshole necessarily made him a great player. I think he was probably great in spite of that in a lot of ways, as you've seen with, you know, the Tom Brady's or the Tim Duncan's of the world. But it's interesting that we got the look into his psychology that he believed that. And the most emotionally raw moment of the documentary was him sort of confirming that as he broke down in tears.
That was the best part of the, yeah. I mean, that was my favorite moment of the doc. And to go back to what the coverage I have consumed and what I have seen as criticism, like, there's nothing, of course, really in here of Jordan's personal life. And that, and I get that on one level, like, it's about the 1997, 1998 Bulls, but like, that moment where you're actually seeing Jordan be emotional, especially after, you know, Kerr said, like, what we all sort of knew, but to hear it from his own teammate was interesting, when Kerr's like, you know, you just couldn't connect with Jordan on an emotional level. To see that emotion, like, it definitely left you wanting more there. I mean, that to me was like that, I think that was the end of episode 7. That was the most compelling thing in the doc.
Yeah. And there was one other moment to me that really got into Jordan's psyche that I thought was, you know, brilliant storytelling. And I would have wanted more of, and that was, they made reference to the point that during his NBA career, he basically was able to function with like a level of mindfulness and living in the moment.
Yes.
That made him immune from pressure because he was constantly, he said he never feared a shot that he hadn't taken yet, mm-hmm. which in my mind is almost anti-human nature. That's not something I can connect with, but seeing that is something that's like we all strive for. But that also brought up something that I've been thinking about since the documentary finished, is that he basically was able to live his entire life from age 14 to 35 in the moment, in the present, focusing on each game and demanding excellence from himself and from everyone around him because of this mindfulness and this mentality. But it almost seems like the moment he retired, the moment that switch flipped and he didn't get the ending that he necessarily wanted going for a seventh championship, he has been sort of living a meandering life, living in the past since. Like, he's almost like the hyper-actualized form of the dad in Friday Night Lights, sitting on the sideline, drinking a Miller Lite with a state championship ring, going, wait till you get yourself one of these to the players so they jog onto the field. I mean, even yesterday, he couldn't resist on the last Davis documentary, chirping his Hornets players, being like, yeah, of course I still think I could beat them in a one-on-one, but I wouldn't want to hurt their feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, I think it's a good point. It's like, you know, people always talk about how difficult it is, not people, but athletes talk about how difficult it is to transition to that second act. Right. And obviously that was difficult for Jordan. Yeah. He unretired twice. I mean, once was probably, I mean, the baseball thing was different, but I think unretiring from the second Bulls stint and coming back to the Wizards, shout out DC, but like that just shows that obviously, like any athlete, he was struggling with that. And to your point, since he retired, it's been, you know, he hasn't been able to win really with the Hornets. And so now it's all about how can I, you know, make that myth still, you know, reign in people's minds. But I don't know. The mindfulness thing is really interesting because, yeah, I was sort of skeptical when they were talking about that, because it's a nice thing to say in retrospect, and it lines up. It's consonant with how he played, obviously, because he was so clutch, but it didn't ring true to me. I don't know if, like, I mean, maybe, I don't know. I have no idea what it's like to be MJ. And obviously it's like, he's a complete anomaly in the human race, but like, it just seems so difficult. And I wonder how much less mindful he would have been if he had social media, right? Like, cause one thing I was going to say, we were talking about earlier, is like, he's an all time team petty person, right? Like, now we get on KD for getting on Twitter and chirping at the trolls. But like, Jordan, man, he's so petty. Like, every little slight, he talked about that list in last night's episode. He would allow that to motivate him to do unbelievable things. But like, if he was on Twitter and he was seeing what people were saying, I just don't know if he would have this ability to be present or ignore the trolls. It would be really interesting to see what he'd be like with a Twitter account.
I mean, he was a real life Arya Stark. He was going to every single person he could and telling them, I have this list. I'm going to cross you off one by one until I get to my ultimate goal. I don't think that MJ can exist again. And that's one of the things that's so interesting about the discourse with him and LeBron and other athletes. Like, the social media world that we live in, it's impossible to be perfect. And part of the veneer of Michael Jordan was that he was perfect for so long and how we viewed him, and that became real. And then there was no imperfections in his on-court game. And so it's like solidified things. And as he rode to the sunset, it made it okay for us to forget the Wizards. It made it okay to forget that he now accepts mediocrity with the Charlotte Hornets. And like, we're able to sort of, in our minds, still build up that he is like a pillar of excellence in everything that he does, even though that's like, you know, we know that with LeBron James, we know that with what happened to Tiger Woods once social media was around, that it's impossible to maintain that bubble of perfection because it's just not real.
For sure. Also, I think the scarcity had something to do with that. Like, this is maybe unrelated, but like, I couldn't believe that scene where, and by scarcity, I just mean like, you know, we're not hearing from Jordan. We weren't hearing from Jordan all the time the way we are with the guys now, because they can speak to us 24/7 and we have direct access to them. But that moment where the media was chasing Rodman.
Oh my God.
I mean, that's some like TMZ shit. You would see that with like a big time celebrity nowadays, like if someone's leaving rehab. But to like, I was imagining if someone would chase down LeBron like that. I don't think that's would happen. And, you know, that again was Rodman. It wasn't MJ, but still that idea that like you would chase him down like that. So I think only like that demand only exists because those guys weren't as available. Right.
Yeah.
Like, that was bizarre to me.
Yeah. I mean, now you get comments from these guys on their Instagram story. It's like, if you want to hear what Steph Curry and LeBron think, they don't need us.
Yeah.
They just say it the way that they want to say it and they put it out there.
Totally. So you go back to your mindfulness point, by the way, Phil Jackson really.
Oh my God.
I mean, you sort of knew this about him in terms of sort of how into mindfulness and meditation and rituals and things like that he was, but man, he was in on that wave early. He would have been like, you know, he was doing Goop before Goop was the trendy thing. You know what I mean?
I thought Phil was one of the winners from this doc. Like, he always seemed like sort of a crunchy, almost fraudulent in how he thought about the world and the way that he was portrayed to us in the 2000s and early aughts, because we saw the downside of him as sort of as an aging basketball person and sort of the basketball world turn on him. But like, he just seems so cool. Like, I want to hang out with Phil.
I love that he gave them the day off to go golf.
It's amazing.
You know what I mean? Like, that just seems so antithetical to what you usually see in sports, especially I guess in football, right? But it's like, you know, we need to work harder and grind our teeth more. And Phil's like, go play golf, it'll help. But yeah, no, to your point, I think like my last memory of Phil Jackson was like the Knicks, because I'm a Knicks fan. And I'm like, oh my God, that was terrible and tarnished his legacy. And then I was like, you know, he never did media. So that was kind of the last taste in my mouth I had. And now he comes back. He looks like this. I mean, he is this unbelievable coach to handle all these egos. Like, the way he dealt with Rodman was unbelievable. He's doing all these things that, like, again, going back to the mindfulness and giving players rest when they need it. Like, he's doing all these things that now people are coming around and being like, this is, you know, our people. They perform more efficiently when we actually do let them recover and rest. And so he just comes off like super smart, super ahead of his time. And yeah, to your point, I think it will leave us with a like different memory of Phil Jackson.
Yeah. I mean, there's such a Peter Pan syndrome in professional sports of all these guys who are massive in a lot of ways, like the most masculine and manly people you can imagine when you just look at them, but they've grown up playing the games that we did as kids. So like emotionally and developmentally, they're still very immature and they're like children. And you see coaches handle them that way a lot of times and talk to them the way that your little league coach would talk to you. But Phil was like, watching him, it made me feel like that guy's like the perfect manager in like an actual office. He treated them like professionals and allowed them to make decisions and sort of manage themselves. And like actually getting like a firsthand view of that was fascinating.
Yeah. And the one area I wanted more on was the Rodman stuff, because I just didn't seem the way MJ handled, like there wasn't enough about MJ and Rodman's relationship, I felt like, because it just didn't make sense to me that a guy as demanding as MJ seems to be, and like, you know, we were talking just a few minutes ago about how that was a big part of this narrative, is like the way MJ was demanding, the way that brought out the best in his teammates, he seemed to just like shrug off Rodman stuff. But the Vegas trip and the Vegas disappearance and the WWE belt, it's just like Jordan didn't flip out about that. That didn't add up to me.
I mean, how long was Jordan in Vegas before he actually knocked on Rodman's hotel room door?
Yeah,
there's no way that was stop one. He took a detour to the blackjack tables.
I guess it goes back to like, if you're performing, that's all Jordan cares about. But it just seemed, it's just amazing that Rodman in the middle, was it the middle of the finals or the Eastern Conference finals?
That was the finals, and they brushed over that. He took a plane from Salt Lake City to go do a professional wrestling event with Hulk Hogan. That, imagine that happening now.
It was incredible. But also Phil's response was great when he was asked, you know, how do you feel about Rodman taking your focus off the finals? And he was like, hasn't taken our focus off the finals, taking your focus off the finals. Damn, that was cold.
It was amazing. I actually thought that was the character development of Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman. Like, I loved getting to know Scottie more in this documentary. Like,
totally.
He was probably the closest person to MJ in the Petty Wars. He had like, he was the most secretly passive aggressive star of this whole documentary, where Jordan was in your face, all of that rubbed off onto Scottie.
That's also definitely aged the best out of anyone in the documentary, I think.
Oh my God, he looks the exact same. It's incredible.
Totally, totally.
Honestly, Who would have bet on Michael looking worse than Dennis Rodman 22 years later?
Yeah, I mean, this is not a necessarily a great advertisement for cigar smoking, I would say. Yeah.
I'm gonna cut this from the podcast just because otherwise Michael will hold a grudge against us.
Did you see on shout out GQ.com, my friend Sam Shuby did an interview with the editor in chief of Cigar Aficionado, and MJ smokes 6 cigars a day. And he smoked a cigar before every home game.
It's unbelievable.
We wanted to do a fake post that was like, how much better would MJ have been if he didn't smoke cigars, and like try to talk some doctors and figure it out.
It's an amazing idea. Oh man. All right. I think we're pretty much there. We just had a smart conversation on the doc. You got anything
else?
Can I give one more
shout out?
Give another shout out.
Scott Burrell is the most patient man on earth. I mean, how did he not lose it? He just kept taking shit from Jordan over and over and over again.
He came off as just like a delightful, awesome dude to hang out with. As someone who's like not an alpha male, as a beta in almost every single argument, I was incredibly happy to have Scott Burrell in my life. Someone who I didn't know existed until 5 weeks ago.
I know. God, I was just really impressed that he didn't ever lose it on MJ.
One more thing before we go. What do you think happens if all the Scott Burrells band together and do lose it on MJ? Like, does that team exist if all of the role players are basically like, F this dude, I'm not playing with him? Because that was Channing Frye's take, basically, that like this could never happen today because of player empowerment, and even the role players have a voice and would never take that type of abuse.
I don't know. I think that's sort of like discounting how singular of a talent MJ is. Like, I think you see him on the floor and you're like, well, you know, I get it. I get why he's so ruthless with me. Like, he's the only guy who can back that up. And so it's sort of like an impossible thought exercise to be like, would this work with today? I don't know if it has to do with the environment or it has to do with the person, right? Like, I don't know if it's so that players have a voice today, or if it's just that there's nobody else who could be a singular leader the way Jordan was. I mean, LeBron obviously is close, and that is arguable. But even still, I just think Jordan's the only person you can back, whose play can back up that sort of a ruthless locker room behavior.
All right. Well, thank you, Clay Skipper. You have made us smarter about Michael Jordan and The Last Dance and social media and modern media. And I really appreciate you coming on with me.
Thanks for having me on, man. Big, big fan of Levitard and all of his friends, including Charlie Kravitz.
Hopefully you dug that. We'll be back at you on Friday with a whole brand new episode of the Mystery Crate. You're going to want to listen to it. That's all I'm going to say. It has to be heard to be believed. I'll leave it at that. We'll see you Friday.